forces. Zaki was one of them. As the Taliban encircled Kabul on August 15, hundreds of Afghans swarmed the runway of Hamid Karzai International Airport, attempting to climb onto a U.S. Air Force transport plane. Zaki made his way to the front and clambered onto the plane's landing gear. As it accelerated past 120 miles per hour, he held tight. His body was found after he plunged from the U.S. military plane as it took off, one of the most tragic and indelible images in the final chapter of the U.S. campaign in Afghanistan. We spoke to Zaki's father 1 year after his son's death. It wasn't easy to convince him at first, but this is our mission, to be the voice of the voiceless.
I just want to see the pilot of the U.S. plane to understand how he could do this. The U.S. claims that it supports human rights, but this is a sheer lie. They kill innocent people. They have not even apologized to me for my son's death. I've waited for a year for a simple apology, but it never happened.
Zaki's brother, Zabih, also lost his life during the Taliban takeover. Many Afghans blame the U.S. for the loss of innocent Afghan lives during the Washington's withdrawal.
There is no doubt that Americans are responsible for such incidents. They caused a chaos and it got out of their control. They knew such events might occur. Falling from planes or getting killed in explosions were the result of Americans' irresponsibility and mismanagement.
The cemetery where Zaki is buried is so close to his house that his father always looks at it through the window of his house every day. We asked him to take us to the cemetery where Zaki's grave is located.
The United Nations is also on their side, and so are the so-called human rights groups. The UN and the human rights are just a lie, as they are simply deceiving people. They are more like a mafia, but an official type. They must somehow pay compensation.
1 year has passed since the U.S. pulled its forces out of Afghanistan, ending almost two-decade occupation of the country. Yet no one has stood trial for the tragedy that happened during their withdrawal. There has been neither any compensation nor an apology that could at least calm those who lost their loved ones. Abdullah Amirzad of Kabul.
The enemy is 600 meters away, and Russian snipers are zeroing their rifles to take down the target. The International Snipers Competition, which has been challenging top-grade shooters from seven countries, including Russia, China, and Azerbaijan, in the Iranian city of Yazd. After 10 days of breathtaking competition, the hosting Iranian teams made it to the top of the podium.
Thank God, the Iranian team won the first place. But what's important is that we as the host have maintained the fair play principle, and this is what the participating teams also admitted, that the refereeing was fair and transparent.
The Chinese team claimed the second place, and the Russian Federation and Uzbekistan jointly rounded off the podium in the third place.
We tried our best to win the top of the podium, but the competition was so tight. I hope we will perform better next year.
Before the competition, we thought we could achieve the first place, but the Iranian snipers are so capable and gave us stiff competition.
Organized by the ground force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the 10-day competition was held in 20 different items, which engaged the snipers in arduous team and individual competitions to test their agility and shooting accuracy in various war conditions.
The competition comprises 20 different items. Some of them are team competitions and others are individual competitions. The contest tries to challenge the competitors' skills in shooting, physical preparedness, and promptitude, among others.
The event came as part of Russia's International Army Games 2022, which hosted over 270 teams from 37 countries and regions. From taking down moving objects to shooting at distant targets, the International Snipers Competition offered a real challenge for some of the select shooters from different countries. So organizers say those who made it to the top are among the most capable shooters in the world. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Yazd.
Hundreds of people attended the Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross office in the Gaza Strip in a move to express their sympathy and unity with Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails and detention centers. They came to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners who kicked off a series of protests last Monday against persistent mistreatment inside regime jails. The event is part of the Friday of Rage in solidarity with Palestinian detainees. During the Friday sermon, Hamas movement warned the Israeli regime against harming Palestinian prisoners.
Our military wings, including the Qassam and Quds brigades, and the military wings of all Palestinian resistance factions, are all united behind the prisoners. We will spare no effort to secure the release of the prisoners. Harming Palestinian prisoners is an attack on all Palestinian resistance factions.
Over the past 4 days, Palestinian detainees held in 24 Israeli prisons have refused to take part in security checks and returned their meals. They also organized sit-ins in prison yards as part of their protest action.
The Israeli prison service reneged on understandings that were previously reached with prisoners' representatives. It imposed punitive measures, including moving tens of detainees to solitary confinement, preventing inmates from going to the prison yard, and banning prisoners from meeting their families. In response to this, the Palestinian prisoners have declared the state of general mobilization last Monday.
In recent weeks, the Israeli prison service increased its oppressive measures against Palestinian prisoners by imposing double isolation on some detainees. Observers say the Palestinian prisoners have become propaganda material for candidates in Israel's elections.
Palestinian prisoners are escalating their actions because they demand better detention conditions. The suffering of Palestinian prisoners increases every time the Israeli regime plans to hold elections. Israeli officials are using the oppression of prisoners as part of their election campaigns.
Currently, there are some 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons, and that figure includes women and children. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has detained more than 1 million Palestinians since the Nakba in 1948, under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
If you're a British citizen waiting for a package to be delivered by Royal Mail, expect a delay. More than 100,000 of the company's workers, hailed as heroes for working through the pandemic, have walked out of the job to fight for a wage rise amid a deepening cost of living crisis.
To come into this action, to get your members motivated.
We didn't create this crisis. The oligarchs in every society, the people that are taking dividends and profits, feeding their own fat tummies and making our people wait for a decent pay rise. That's what's causing inflation, but it's also what's causing bitterness between the classes. Now, we've got to make sure that we rebalance that equation.
The bosses at Royal Mail, a 500-year-old multinational, now privatized postal service, claims the Communication Workers Union, which represents these strikers, has rejected a pay rise offer worth up to more than 5% after 3 months of talks. The union's leader says that's simply not true.
The reason why it's a lie is because it doesn't exist. It's a total fabrication, and it's being spun to the media, embarrassingly, really, to try and make the company look as though they're being reasonable when what they're actually doing is just disgraceful. So the real situation is that the company made £758 million profit. The company gave away over £400 million to major shareholders and then imposed a 2% pay increase to the workforce.
The walkout is being described as the biggest industrial action of the summer so far, which has already seen workers strike across the railways, ports and the courts. They all come at a time when the UK is grappling with its highest inflation rate and soaring energy prices in decades.
Today's strike action is the opening salvo in a dispute that could reshape a British institution. And the strikers tell us that they're in it for the long haul. Saeed Purizza, London.
Iran has held an automotive exhibition titled The New Era of Iran's Automotive Industry. The event provides an opportunity for auto parts manufacturers and automakers to establish better bonds and meet the needs of the industry and the market through joint cooperation.
We have plans to reform the structure of our automotive industry as well as the relations between auto parts manufacturers and automakers. Moreover, under the plan, the overall promised production target will be achieved in 2025.
According to a report released by the International Organization of Motor Vehicle Manufacturers, OICA, Iran has been ranked the world's 19th biggest automaker in 2021. Based on the OICA data, Iranian automakers produced almost 900,000 vehicles in 2021. That marked a 2% increase compared to 2020.
We have done a lot of work in the automotive industry, but there is still much to do. A car has more than 2,000 parts, and every day 4,000 cars are produced in the country. We do not have any other industries with such managerial, economic, and technological complexities.
The Iranian manufacturers currently produce 6 different types of vehicles, including passenger cars, 4WD trucks, buses, minibuses, and pickup trucks. The sector has directly employed about 500,000 people and many more in related industries. About 75% of local output is passenger cars, while pickups come in the second place with around 15%.
The auto industry is a key driving force in Iran, the operation and prosperity of which keeps almost 60 other industries moving. The industry is only second to its energy sector, accounting for almost 10% of the gross domestic product. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Last year, when U.S. military forces were withdrawing from Afghanistan, thousands of foreign and Afghan citizens were also trying to get out of the country. In those days, thousands of people gathered outside the airport in the hope that they can go inside and catch a flight out. But American and NATO forces failed to control the situation, and then came a disaster. This side of the canal is where U.S. soldiers were standing, using the barbed wire not to let people pass. And this canal is where people were trying to pass and get over the ridge. The explosion also killed plus 183 persons.
I saw people, including women and children, who were running. There were people carrying the wounded with wheelbarrow. Many of the dead and wounded people were thrown into the canal. Women were running and screaming, trying to get to the hospital. We were so close, so we went there and did what we could do to help them.
It was around 6 p.m. when a suicide bomber entered a crowd of disturbed people and detonated his vest just outside the International Airport of Kabul on August 26th last year. At least 183 people were killed, including 170 Afghan civilians and 13 members of the United States Army. Some say all that blood is on the hands of the Americans.
In my opinion, Americans are solely responsible for that disaster. The chaos around the airport was deliberately created by the Americans as a cover to allow them to escape. On the other hand, they were aware that such incidents are probable. So why didn't they stop the evacuation process? Why didn't they disperse the people?
Also, some citizens blame gunfire by U.S. troops after the explosion for at least some of the deaths.
We can't confirm that.
And, the Pentagon in a conference acknowledged that possibly U.S. was responsible for some deaths, but later on they said that ball bearings in the explosive vest created holes in bodies resembling bullet holes. Although this explanation sounds so fishy, it is still not known if gunfire caused some deaths or not. Just hours before the attack, U.S. diplomats in Kabul warned citizens to stay away from the city's airport. They were aware of what was about to come, but were not willing to take any steps towards preventing it. Abdullah Amirzad of Kabul.
Thousands of people rallied in the Gaza Strip to celebrate the Islamic Jihad's victory against the Israeli regime and assert the unity among Palestinian resistance groups. Earlier this month, Israeli forces assassinated a top Islamic Jihad military commander in Gaza, prompting retaliatory attacks by Palestinian resistance movements. Israeli forces killed 49 Palestinians, including 17 children, during the 3 days of fighting. The Islamic Jihad maintains that it has achieved an honorable victory in the latest confrontation with the Israeli regime. Addressing the rally through satellite transmission, Islamic Jihad Secretary General Ziad al-Nakhala praised the unity among all Palestinian resistance groups during the three-day war.
The thousands of people attending this rally today are proof that all Palestinian resistance factions are united against the Israeli enemy. We assert today during this victory and unity rally that armed resistance is the only way to liberate Palestine and regain our rights.
The popularity of Islamic Jihad movement continues to gain momentum among Palestinians due to its refusal to recognize the Israeli regime and its adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli occupation. During the 3 days of intense fighting, the Islamic Jihad rockets shattered Israel's so-called invincibility myth.
Al-Quds Brigade is sending a very strong message today to the Israeli enemy regarding the growing might of the Palestinian resistance. The enemy thought that assassinating Al-Quds Brigade commanders will weaken the Islamic Jihad, but that did not happen. Al-Quds Brigade are stronger today than ever and will continue to fight for the sake of liberating Al-Quds.
During the 3 days of fighting, the Islamic Jihad military wing fired hundreds of rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories. Observers say that the Islamic Jihad fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime, forcing Tel Aviv to demand a ceasefire.
The strength of the Palestinian resistance has forced the Israeli enemy to ask for a truce. The Palestinian resistance is here to protect the Palestinian people and to liberate our land. The Al-Quds brigades have managed to fire hundreds of rockets at the enemy and forced it to evacuate their towns and run for cover.
Five wars have been unleashed between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza since 2008.
Experts believe that in any future war, the Israeli regime will be dealt a heavy blow by Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Afghanistan has accused Pakistan of providing airspace for U.S. drones to enter the country. It has called it a clear invasion by the Americans of Afghanistan and its airspace. If this is true, what gains will this have for the U.S.? And why would Pakistan allow this to happen? What is in it for them? This is while these comments come less than a month after U.S. President Joe Biden claims the killing of al-Qaeda chief Ayman al-Zawahiri in a drone strike in Kabul, while also marking 1 year since the drone killing of 9 members of a family that were mistaken for Daesh terrorists. First, let's talk to Abdullah Amirzada, correspondent over in Kabul, to get the latest on these statements. Abdullah Amirzada, at this point, we know what Afghanistan has said regarding these drone operations by the U.S. illegally in the country. Tell us more about their reaction to this, and of course, if we've heard anything from Pakistan as of yet.
Well, yes. As of yet, the Pakistani officials have not said anything yet on this matter. As our condolences with them, they are dealing with the flood thing. They have not said anything yet on this matter. But the experts are giving their opinions. They say now with the drones in Afghanistan's airspace, people have the right to be scared. As a truth, you can hear the drones right now flying on the space of Kabul. The experts say, as we remember, as people remember, 1 year ago, a drone strike took the lives of 10 members of one family. The Americans said at first that they thought it was an ISIS shelter, ISIS house, but it turned out to be a relief worker, an aid worker's house, killing 7 children and 3 adults. And also, the experts are saying now that this is highly probable that the drones attack to some aims or maybe actually target people, target houses, as we witnessed almost a month ago. The U.S. drones aimed a house, targeted a house, and as they said, they killed the leader of Al-Qaeda, which is yet exactly unknown. The Taliban are saying that they were not aware of the attack. The United States did not give them actually any information before their attack. And they also say that they do not know if there was any member of Al-Qaeda hiding in that house. As of now, we only know that the Pakistani officials have not said anything on this matter. And this is almost the whole information that we have yet. We must wait more to see what the response of the side of Pakistani is.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Abdullah Amirzadeh. We appreciate it. That's the correspondent there from Kabul.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me now introduce our guest for this edition of the program. John Stuffer joins us. He's the director of the Foreign Policy and Focus from Northampton, Massachusetts. Also joining us on the phone is James DeCross, former U.S. diplomat, who joins us from Virginia. Welcome to you both. John Pfeffer, let me first start with you. We're looking at an accusation that Afghanistan has leveled against Pakistan and in turn the U.S. in a sense. Of the fact that Pakistan has allowed the U.S. to use its airspace and in turn fly into Afghanistan's airspace with its drones and to conduct airstrikes. So the first question is, why would Pakistan allow that? What is its gain? And also then the U.S. goals from doing this?
Well, Pakistan has had a relationship with the United States. It's, of course, been up and down over the years, depending on who's in charge in Washington and who's in charge in Pakistan. But of course, you know, there has been significant economic assistance that has gone to Pakistan, occasionally security assistance. So Pakistan gains something from the relationship with the United States. The United States, meanwhile, when it withdrew its troops a year ago from Afghanistan, it said it would maintain an over-the-horizon presence. In other words, it would continue to be involved in Afghanistan, with the assistance of other countries in the region. The most logical country, of course, would be Pakistan. And so it's not such a surprise, perhaps, that Pakistan would align itself with the United States on this particular maneuver. And of course, you know, from time to time, Pakistanis have had their disagreements with the Taliban, both the Taliban on the ground and the Taliban in power. And so it is to the advantage of the Pakistanis, I suppose, to keep the Taliban guessing. And perhaps it goes without saying that the Pakistanis are not thrilled, of course, about some of the more extreme factions on the ground in Afghanistan, including Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
James Dutrois, so what is your impression of the way that Pakistan has cooperated with the U.S. in terms of allowing it to have drones fly into Afghanistan? Again, what gain does Pakistan have from this? And, of course, what kind of use will the U.S. have? Is this short-term, or is this going to be a one-off, or is it going to be continuous?
Well, I think I agree objectively with what the previous speaker said, and I think this is part of what we need to address with the United States finds itself globally, not only after the Afghanistan mission, Ukraine, and also the current confrontation with China. But I think Washington is working around what can, where it can gain them using drones like Somalia, government in April, where it appeared earlier that Washington was trying to maybe broaden the perspective that we now have so long whatever Washington wants. Okay, what in Afghanistan, having built it after more than 20 years. If we can't control the place, at least we can disrupt it. And I think this project for are holding money that has been allocated for development. And as we know, this has led to a lot of hardship in Afghanistan.
Okay, we're going to try to actually get a reestablished line with you again, James Dutrois. It was kind of hard to decipher what you were saying. John Pfeffer, however, let me come to you now. We're looking at another incident that involved a drone strike by the U.S. president, in which Joe Biden announced the killing of the al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri, and this happened in a drone strike in Kabul. Now, what's really strange about this, which the Taliban have expressed, and in response to the drone strike, what the U.S. has said, and that is the Taliban says it's not sure if Zawahiri was killed, and the U.S. has said he has been killed. We're not going to provide any evidence. No DNA. The case is closed. Why would the U.S. Present that in such a form and manner? And what do you think? Do you think Zawahiri was killed?
Well, those are tough questions. I mean, I obviously don't have any inside information as to whether Zawahiri was or was not killed. I think the United States, of course, doesn't have a presence on the ground in Afghanistan. It is thus very difficult for the United States to provide kind of forensic evidence to prove that Zawahiri was in fact killed by the drone strike. Obviously, the United States was tracking his movements for many months. They proved in some sense that they didn't need intelligence on the ground, or at least they haven't admitted that there's any intelligence on the ground, which was one of the major criticisms of the Biden administration's withdrawal 1 year ago. In other words, critics said, how can you possibly ensure that the United States will prevent the rise of or the strengthening of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, Khorasan, in Afghanistan? And the United States, in some sense, is using this drone strike as a rebuttal, as saying, look, we in fact don't need the intelligence on the ground. We have plenty of tactics at our disposal, plenty of surveillance, and we have used it to kill the leader of Al-Qaeda. Now, it also should be pointed out that Zawahiri is probably not the most, shall we say, active of leaders on the ground. I mean, he's an old man, or was an old man, quite sick, probably didn't have, you know, a great deal of operational control over al-Qaeda, but nevertheless was kind of important as a symbol. So, you know, in some sense, what the Biden administration has said is we've killed this symbol. As for producing the body, that's less important. What's more important is that we killed this symbolic leader. We don't have to actually provide any greater proof of that. If you can demonstrate that we didn't, in other words, if you can produce a live body of Zawahiri, then go ahead and do so. Until you do so, we have declared our mission successful.
Taking a look at the fact that you have these drone strikes that have happened, and of course it was something that happened quite often at some points during the 20-year occupation, are we looking at an increase at U.S. drone operations? As you just said, many within Washington actually criticized Joe Biden for the way, not only for the way that the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan, but for the fact that they are very unsure about how much of a danger either we call them Daesh terrorists, you called it IS Khorasan, in Afghanistan is going to play against U.S.'s national security as time goes by. So is this part of a trend now of U.S. counterterrorism activity, as they would like to call it?
Well, that's a good question. And again, it's difficult to say because, in fact, over the last year, there hasn't been a lot of drone activity, especially in comparison to the Obama years. Donald Trump, of course, was very enamored of drone strikes and also made it more difficult to know the extent of the U.S. drone war by making U.S. drone activities far more secretive. When Biden came into office, he actually ordered a review of drone policy, in some sense to make it more transparent, also to get a sense of, you know, what the extent of drone activities are and whether they were necessary in various theaters of operation. When it comes to Afghanistan, to be honest, I think a great deal will depend on what's going on inside Afghanistan. Not so much U.S. Counterterrorism strategy, as you pointed out, in part because the United States is really focused on other things right now. It's obviously focused on Ukraine and providing Ukraine with military assistance, very focused on China, containing China, and doing an uptick in military maneuvers in East Asia, particularly around Taiwan, and resuming, along with South Korea, military maneuvers there. Afghanistan, to be entirely honest with you, has really decreased in its priority in U.S. strategy right now. We don't have troops on the ground. There is no allied government in Kabul that, you know, we have to provide assistance to. And, you know, as the last your other speaker said, the main focus is really around the delivery of Afghan funds that have been held in U.S. banks, and whether, you know, the United States will deliver that money back to Afghanistan. I mean, it's Afghanistan's money. It's just, you know, the United States has been dragging its feet, shall we say, in terms of returning that money. And in an important legal case, there has been an effort to turn at least half of that money over to 9/11, September 11th survivors. So there's a lot of controversy around that money. But that's where the emphasis is right now, frankly. And unless there's a real uptick in activity of, as you said, Daesh or of al-Qaeda, and when I say uptick in activity, I really mean uptick in activity outside the borders of Afghanistan. I don't think the United States cares that much about the internal politics inside Afghanistan. And as I'm sure your listeners know, there's considerable disagreements, shall we say, or considerable conflicts between the Taliban and Daesh and al-Qaeda. And there are other, of course, even conflicts within the Pashtun community inside Afghanistan. So I think, you know, all of that is, internal questions that the United States, frankly, no longer cares that much about unless it spills over the borders of Afghanistan.
Well, the whole issue with the funds is a big deal, and it is quite the focus of what seems to be the U.S. focus at this point as to what to do here. And I'm very curious as to why the funds have not been returned. Many are questioning that within Afghanistan. But the question comes about is what are the reasons for the U.S. not to do this? They have put into focus mm-hmm. women's rights. That's been something that they have said time and again as to the reasons why. And also maybe a little bit of, not a little bit, but maybe a degree of mistrust when it comes to the recognition of Taliban, which the U.S. really has not done, and what the funds are going to, where are they going to go? But when you're looking at a country that's suffering the way that it is with the humanitarian situation, that is probably one of the worst now in the world, women's rights doesn't quite rank on top of the list here. People's lives should rank, unless there are other motives, because this is now happening in a country where it's very unstable, given the economic situation. Why do you think it is that the U.S. is dragging its feet when it comes to these funds?
Well, I think you answered your own question very effectively. I think the United States is very skeptical about the Taliban as an authority, as a government. It has suspected that any money, whether it's Afghan money or international community money or humanitarian aid from agencies, that money will not go toward their intended recipients. The United States fears that the Taliban government will take any money that it receives and either spend it on something else, guns, so forth, or it will disappear in corruption. And of course, the United States unfortunately has a very bad record over 20 years, even when it was, theoretically leading anti-corruption efforts inside Afghanistan, of seeing U.S. aid disappear into the hands of those who were not the intended recipients.
All right. Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate your comments. John Pfeffer there, Director of the Foreign Policy and Focus, is talking to us there from Northampton, Massachusetts. Unfortunately, James Dutross, former U.S. diplomat from Virginia, we could not reestablish a connection with him. We do apologize for that. And that is for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kavitawi, and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
under the starry sky of the desert. From the very heart of evergreen forests. With the radiance of silver-colored sand. In the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Oh, I slept a lot. I have to get up. Time for breakfast and a new beautiful summer day in Kashan. Thank God I can make tea in an old Iranian teapot and samovar here. I'm fine, thanks. Actually, I've resided in the famous Amiriha house. For today, I'm going to visit the traditional bazaar of Kashan. Thank you. Bye-bye. The historical Kashan Bazaar is one of the must-see attractions of the city of Kashan and also one of the most significant traditional bazaars of Iran that will amaze visitors with its artistic architecture and nostalgic atmosphere. Just like other traditional bazaars of Iran that are considered as the main elements of the city's old texture, the roofed Kashan Bazaar is surrounded with other historical monuments of the city like old mosques, caravanserais, abambar or water cisterns, covering an area known as the city's old district. This bazaar dates back to the Buyid and Seljuqid eras. It started booming during the Safavid era, and what is remained is a bazaar which is built on the remains of the old bazaar during the Qajarid era. This bazaar is registered in Iran National Heritage List. Thank you. time to go. Yes, I'm going to visit the Bazaar of Kashan today. But I'm afraid it's not possible to visit the entire bazaar in just half a day. Kashan is a very special city, full of old stunning sights. So, here it is. Good. Not a long way to go. Oh God. Look at the city. I'm crazy about these adobe-made walls. This city looks like a history book. I'm excited to visit this bazaar. It said this bazaar has been one of the most important trade centers of the past until today. Well, I am now at the traditional bazaar of Kashan. Wow. Just from the entrance of this bazaar, you can guess this market is an Iranian Islamic architectural masterpiece. The architecture and main structure of this bazaar looks like all bazaars of Iran. This bazaar constitutes different sections like Raste, Sara, Timche, and Chahar Sok. I am now in Mianchal Chahar Sok. Well, it has old wooden gates. You may not believe, but this Chahar Sok is one of the most beautiful sections of this market. Here I am in Aminodole Timche. This part of the bazaar is the old section of the bazaar. The entrance of Aminodole Timche has tile works. This section is surrounded by old wooden windows and old bricks. This part of the bazaar has astonishing architecture. Most of the carpet selling stores are in this Timche. And here we have the copper market, one of the attractive sections of the bazaar, in my opinion. Yes, the familiar sound of hammers on copper. I may buy these cooking wares. Oh, very beautiful. Good souvenirs. Well, art is long and time is short. Of course, the traditional bazaar of Kashan is more than what I described for you, but I have to come back to Tehran before night. In the future, I may come back here to see the details of this astonishing bazaar of beautiful Iran. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.